So tell me more about what you did after you finished the school.
After I finished school, I went to Frankfurt on Main, for 2 years as an apprentice in a wholesale drapery business, a very big wholesale drapery business called Aumann und Rapp. I went to Frankfurt in 1926. By that time I was 17 years of age. And by that time, going away from home wasn't much of a problem anymore. One was a semi-adult and just accepted that you had to go away from home. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of course, became very friendly with the other Jewish people who were in that school. We had, not in that business, we had a football team, a private football team, but we played football every Sunday or went out. By that time we owned bicycles, we went out cycling on a Sunday or we went swimming. So my time in Frankfurt was really very pleasantly spent. I had plenty of Jewish company, boys as well as girls. And, well, it all weren't very pleasant. I think the only one of the things I can remember, but that wasn't an anti-Semitic affair, was they had the people, the packers, who were in the packing room. Most of them were non-Jewish, but I don't think that had anything to do with it. They had the habit that every new apprentice who joined the firm had to be initiated. So one day, somebody sent me with a fictitious message to the packing room. Of course, I was, at that time, I hadn't been there more for about 6 weeks or so. I did suspect anything, so they sent me there with a message. As I was in the packing room, one of the packers shut the door and they were going to give me a hiding, which is what the initiation ceremony. However, I never in all my life have I taken things lying down. I jumped on top of some boxes, I fought like a lion, and I smashed the spectacles of the senior packer who afterwards wanted me to pay for it, and I said, not in your so-and-so life. You started it and you got what you were looking for. So it took them a long time to get used to the fact that I had not allowed myself to be initiated without heading out. So I was there, as I say, from 1926 to 1928. After I had served my apprenticeship, my parents and I decided that I would go home and join my father in his business in Leutershausen. I learned to drive, and later on I had a motor car when I went out calling on customers in Leutershausen. Yes, we had a football club which I joined, which at that time was partly, half of the members were young Jewish lads like myself, and some of the others were non-Jewish. We got on very well, and for a while we managed to politically influence the football club to be anti-Nazi. but the pressure grew gradually. By that time, based on my experience, probably at the school in Ansbach, I had become very politically minded, and I joined the so-called Reichsbanner Schwarz-Rot Gold, which was a paramilitary organization which based itself on the democratic Weimar Constitution. It was in no way communist influenced, and the Reichsbanner Schwarz-Rot Gold drew its members from the Social Democratic Party in Germany, from the Democratic Party, and from the Catholic Center Party, which means it was the center of the German political spectrum. As I was the most active, I became the leader of our Ortsgruppe, a local group, and I was fairly active. So a lot of my business travel took me through the town of Ansbach, which had a very strong social democratic group and a very strong Reichsbanner Gruppe. And I regularly popped in at the office of the man who led the group in Ansbach, who was a local reporter for a socialist newspaper in Nuremberg. So very often passing through Ansbach, I would pop in and we would discuss political things and so on. The Reichsbanner Schwarz-Rot Gold, by the way, we were paramilitary. We did wear some sort of uniform, which was a green shirt, black trousers, shoulder strap, and a navy blue cap. And I felt very proud and very important wearing it. Jewish people felt you should keep your head down and not draw attention to yourself. It wasn't my idea. So one day I had organized a Reichsbanner district meeting in our own town, in Leutershausen. And we had uniform groups from 3 or 4 other places in Mittelfranken who all came to Leutershausen, and we marched through Leutershausen with the Schwarz-Rot Gold flags flying, and I was marching at the head of the column. My father, I will never forget my father's face when he saw me walking in the front. I will admit that there was quite a lot of trouble afterwards in Leutershausen. My parents regularly had stones and bricks thrown through the window. Occasionally they tried to beat me up, which they weren't terribly successful. But I had before mentioned my good friend, my best friend, Otto Gutmann, who was with me in the Reichsbanner. And Otto was one of these people, if you got into a fight, you could rely on Otto. He wouldn't leave your side I wasn't bad, but as a as taking care of myself, but Otto could take on two or three. So Otto and I became very, very firm friends, and the political situation in Leutershausen became worse and worse. In the end, our football club joined with a local Turnverein, Athletics Association, and they didn't allow Jewish youngsters to play anymore. In fact, all the people who had been in the football club with us, they all, most of them turned as anti-Semitic.
That was what year?
That was 1930-31. You see, I came back home in 1928. So by that time, the political situation in Leutershausen grew worse. I built up on a new area for our business where previously we had no customers, in the area between Ansbach and Nuremberg. But I had, through the anti-Semitic experiences which I had made both at the high school and so on, I had become very politically interested. Apart from being the local leader of the Republican Defense Organization, which was called Reichsbanner Schwarz-Rot-Gold, I also did a little bit of journalistic work, writing articles for a Republican paper, which a Republican weekly, which I would say was a very hard-hitting paper. It wasn't a very high standard journalistic type of publication, but it was very strongly, it had no other news except the defense on the attack, defense of the Weimar Republic and attacks on the NSDAP, the Nazi Party. And the paper was called The Alarm, A-L-A-R-M. And whenever I had an article in it, I signed it with my full name, which always produced bricks being thrown through our window at home. Right. Which wasn't also, my parents weren't terribly pleased with me, being so active. And obviously, being older, they were not used to being, they didn't like it being attacked. My life in Leutershausen went on for a couple of years. In 1931, my parents and I decided that I would better not stay at home. I wasn't prepared to stop my political activities, and they weren't terribly keen on being the target for stone throwing and so on in their house. So I decided I would go to Berlin. I had my father's older brother lived in Berlin, and he had an export office in Berlin, and he was mainly a buying agent for the great universal stores in Great Britain. In early 1931, when I went to Berlin and took up a very minor office job in my uncle's office, My uncle, by the way, was called Max Ansbacher. I, of course, rejoined the Reichsbanner in Berlin, and I lived in Dix in the district of Charlottenburg, which is one of the part of Berlin and the west of Berlin. I became very closely associated with Dr. Helmut Klotz. I spent much time in his company. Whenever he went out making speeches in any part of Berlin to other units of the Reichsbanner, I would come along with him in uniform. So I gradually the Nazi party got hold of my name as well. And occasionally I got telephone calls threatening me that the same thing would happen to my friend, to me as to my friend Dr. Klotz. Now it happened at some time in 1900, early in 1932, when Dr. Klotz was in his correspondence position, in position as a reporter in the German parliament in the Reichstag, that three or four Nazi members of parliament attacked him and were trying to kill him, but some other people intervened and he got very badly beaten up, but not badly hurt, but he had to go to hospital. I read that as I went for lunch and saw the headlines of the newspapers being sold in the street. I read about that attack which had taken place on him. I phoned Dr. Klotz's wife and asked her, did she know anything about what had happened to Helmut? She said, I don't know anything else except what's in the paper. So I got in touch with the unit of the Reichsbanner to which I belonged. I will talk to that in a few minutes. And organized half a dozen youngsters to meet me at a Tempelhof subway station to take up the protection of Dr. Klotz's house, because he was coming back out of hospital that afternoon, which we did. He was quite a... although he was very pleased that we would do all that for him, he was a very courageous man. The Reichsbanner was formed as an organization of former active soldiers to protect the Republican government. And people like us who were too young to have been in the First World War were in a unit called the Jungbanner. Jung, Y-U-N-G, B-A-N-N-E-R. The leader of the local Charlottenburg group of the Jungbanner was a very nice Jewish lad who lived in the street next to me, next to mine, in Berlin. So I became very friendly with him. And I joined a special organization, a special group in the Jungbanner, which got a kind of, we were partly trained by the Berlin police in street fighting techniques, in the use of arms, and we were some kind of, well, commando group when we went out on various actions. All we carried was a card with our number. We all had a number and a photograph, and that was all. We never carried anything with our names. But it was good fun. I liked it. So there was plenty political activity. So we would either, at night, we often went out putting posters, sticking posters on the walls, putting our sign, our logo on the walls, and at the same time, if we met any Nazis who were out doing the same, obviously we were trying to tear theirs down, or we would get into fights at street corners. In the middle of 1932, I cannot remember exactly when it was, but it must have been in June or July. The whole political order in Germany changed. One knew that this change of government, which was in a way illegal, would be the people who would even or prepare the way for Hitler to come to power. So we in the Reichsbanner felt we had been trained just for a situation like that, and most of us expected that together with the trade unions and the Prussian police, which at that time was definitely friendly to the and supportive of the democratic government, that we would have to fight a civil war against the Nazi party, against the stormtroopers. However, our leaders were either too much of a coward, or maybe they knew better, maybe they were pacifists, whatever. They decided that no, there was no sense in having a civil war. We had all gathered in the various headquarters which had been assigned to us, where we had our regular meetings, and we were waiting for the what, that to pick up arms somewhere and go out. Instead of that, we got what, we should go home, we would not fight, that we would regain, the Republican government would regain power at the next parliamentary elections, which of course never, the parliamentary elections took place, but everybody knew that there was no future for the Republican government if they didn't stand up to this test. In fact, most of our youngsters were very disappointed of not being given the fight. Many of us might not have survived it, but if we had been allowed to fight, we might have avoided the Second World War by not allowing a Nazi government to come to power. But this, the last opportunity to save the Republican government, was missed, and from then on it was a gradual slide into the Nazi dictatorship. As my last word about the Reichsbanner, may I say that one of the main functions we also had was protecting any political meeting organized by the Social Democratic Party, by the Democratic Party, or by the Catholic Center Party. These were the three parties which which formed the backbone of the government and of the Weimar Republic, and it had for a long time been the aim both of the communists with their active organization and the Nazi stormtroopers to make it impossible for democratic parties to hold proper election meetings. Because if the one or the other would make trouble at a political meeting, the police would have to intervene, and for the sake of public order would have to close the meeting and say to the people to go home. It was our job at those meetings, if there were any groups of communists or stormtroopers there, that we took charge of the situation. We would bundle them up and get them out of the meeting so that the meeting could go on and the police would not need to intervene. That was one of the jobs also which we had to do, and which we did quite successfully. By the late autumn of 1932, my parents and a distant cousin of my father's, a second degree cousin who also lived in Leutershausen, the both families decided to move away from Leutershausen and move down to a town called Landshut, Landshut, which was in Niederbayern, which was the area north of Munich, between Munich and Regensburg. This was a Catholic area. I think I mentioned it earlier on in my remarks that it was the Lutheran Protestant areas and population of Germany which were the first to fall to victim or to follow the Hitler doctrine, whereas the Catholics did not. So this area was a Catholic area. It was a town of about 30,000 people.
So you moved to Landshut with...
Yeah, well, our... Both my father, my mother, and those cousins of ours, Fritz and Selma Ansbacher. I was the only child. They had three children, and their eldest son was Wilhelm. And the plan was that Wilhelm and I would together open a draper's shop in Landshut, and that Wilhelm and I would be the sole partners, although our two fathers did support us. First of all, they provided the capital to open the business, and they also helped in the running of the business, although they were officially retired, but they helped us. So I moved down to Landshut in October 1932, and by that time had completely stopped political activity. I didn't think there was any sense any longer. And we opened that business, which existed, and I may almost say blossomed, until the end of 1938, at the time of the Reichskristallnacht. In fact, we had rented premises in the middle of the town, and the owners of that property were two very respectable retired old German army colonels. And they had let that the shop part, the ground floor of the building, to us, and gradually, that happened later, in 1934 or 35, the local Nazi party in Landshut forced those two old gentlemen to come to us one day, almost with tears in their eyes, confessing to us that they had to break their word and cancel the shop contract, the rent contract, which was had still quite a number of years to run. They told us that they had been threatened, that they would see to it that their war pension would be withdrawn or cancelled if they would show themselves as being supporters of the Jews. And they were really terrorized and they couldn't do anything else. But we did have a chance to get another property whose owner was somebody who was also retired, but somebody of independent means, whom the Nazi party could not put under pressure. And we carried on business in those new premises until the end of 1938. Hitler came to power in January 1933. By April 1933, it was somewhere around 11 or 12 o'clock during the day, the Sturmtroopers appeared in our business, declared all of us, my father, our relative Fritz Ansbacher, my cousin Wilhelm, my business partner, and myself, as having to be taken into what they call Schutzhaft, or protective custody, which normally should be that somebody is being taken into police protection for his own safety. But they termed the Nazi party, who run the country on very much on the lines of the Weimar on the letter of the Weimar Republic, but not in the spirit of the Weimar Republic Constitution, turned that round, and people all over Germany got arrested and taken into Schutzhaft, not for their protection, but for the protection of the public from their interest. So, right. The funny thing was that I had owned a revolver, and Fritz Ansbacher had owned a revolver. And we were always going to work with the revolvers in our pocket, but that morning, for some reason or other, he had a premonition and I had a premonition that something was going to happen. And he, without telling me, and I, without telling him, took the revolver out of my pocket and hit it in the business, and so did he. And the first thing that happened when the stormtroopers came into the business, they searched us for weapons, because at that time it was when Jewish people were arrested and had weapons in their pocket, that made the situation considerably worse, because by that time the Nazi party had issued a law that no Jew was allowed to own firearms. However, as I say, with some premonition, we had both taken those revolvers out of our pocket and hidden them in the business. So they came in, they took us to the local police station. We were there in that local police station for about 5 weeks. I cannot say that we were maltreated, because once you were in the police station, from the police station taking to the local prison, you were in the hands of prison warders who were not stormtroopers, who were people who were prison warders by profession. And so we were not really badly treated. We were kept there for a purpose. One day, my Wilhelm Ansbacher, my cousin, my business partner, and I were released from the prison, from the protective custody. Beg your pardon? That was after five weeks. But our fathers were still kept. And somehow or other, I cannot remember the exact details, we were told we should get in touch with a certain Nazi party solicitor who might be able to arrange the release of our fathers as well. Now, this Nazi solicitor, he was quite a decent man personally, really, had his offices in Regensburg, which was the county town for the district of Niederbayern. And my cousin and I went there to have a talk with him, and he said he would come to Landshut and undertake to consult with the local Nazi party and see what could be done. Of course, he probably knew already what could be done. And amazingly, he stayed and slept in our private house while he was there for 2 or 3 days. He came, after his meeting with the Nazi party, he came back and said, yes, it was a question of money, that somehow or other we had offended the people's opinion in this town, and that if we made a considerable financial donation, this could all be smoothed out. He went to Munich to see the Nazi chief of police, who was Heydrich, who later on became the one of the heads of the German of the Gestapo, and was killed in Czechoslovakia, because he was the chief of police of Czechoslovakia, or was it the Reichsstatthalter or Reichsgauleiter of Czechoslovakia? So, Mr. Heydrich seems to have agreed to that move, and that solicitor came back to us, quoted a sum which I think was somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 Deutschmark plus Fritz Ansbacher's motor car, which was a kind of a sporty car, and the local Nazi party, the leader of the local stormtroopers, had taken a fancy to that car, and he was going to run it himself. So, after financial arrangements were made to hand this amount of money over to the local Nazi party leaders, our fathers were released from protective custody without any further trouble. So after this release from Schutzhaft, we carried on, we reopened our business, and we carried on the business as before, and I must say that our customers, in spite of attempts by the Nazi Party to boycott Jewish businesses, our customers kept on coming. In fact, very often people said to us, going to a Jewish shop was the only way where the population could oppose Hitler's ideas. And our turnover in the business went up year after year, right until the end, when our business was forcibly closed down at the time of the Reichskristallnacht in 1938. So I lived in Landshut. I had a lot of Landshut had a very, very small Jewish population. There were only about 9 or 10 Jewish families, and there was no Jewish community. So on Yom Tovim, people would either go to Munich or somewhere else for the services. I had a lot of friends in Landshut, all non-Jewish, and I also played football in a non-Jewish football team, but gradually the pressure grew. Then one day the Nazi party notified the football team that they would have to exclude me from their team because Jews shouldn't play in a football team anymore, and if they refused to exclude me and throw me out, they would close down the team. So all my friends there in that football team said, we are refusing to exclude Martin from the team. He's a nice chap. We have nothing against him. Close down the football team. We are not going to exclude him. And this is what happened. They closed down the team. So I continued to meet a lot of those, a lot of the people who used to be in that football team were also very personal friend of mine, but it gradually became more and more difficult for them to openly associate privately. One of the last few was the son of one of the local bakers. He had a motorcycle and I had a motorcycle. We were very keen motorcyclists. And to avoid any trouble for him, we would meet outside our town on Sundays. We had would make arrangements where we would meet with our bikes and then drive off to the mountains. At some point or other, somewhere or other, people who knew us must have seen us. Because one day his father got a visit from one of the local Nazi leaders and said, "Your son is still keeping friends with Jews. Either he's going to stop that, or you will no longer deliver bread to the local barracks." That man had a contract with for the German army barracks to supply so many hundred loaves of bread a day. And the fellow phoned me and said, "Martin, this is the case. I could stand up to them, but it's my father's business." So I could understand that as well. Mm-hmm. So that was the last of my friends I openly associated with. And at this point, I think I also ought to make mention a former girlfriend of mine, a non-Jewish girlfriend in Landshut. She was sales girl in a business, in a business, not in ours. And we, whenever we went away for the weekend, we had made plans, we would meet in Munich or somewhere else and go away. Now, one day, she was employed with a national company who had branches all over Germany, kind something like a small supermarket. Those days supermarkets were smaller. And she was moved to another town in Bavaria, in Upper Bavaria, which was the other side of Munich, which was the side nearer and on nearer the mountains, in the upland of the mountains, the Alps. And I had warned her, "Never have my photograph on your bedside table." Well, she made a mistake. She had it on her bedside table. And one day, another girl was transferred to that branch who had also been to Landshut and who saw my photograph. And she said, "That's one of the Ansbacher boys." She said, "Yes." So she must have notified the head office of that, of the Nazi district, because within a couple of days of that girl seeing my photograph, the area manager, area personnel manager of that company appears in that business. He calls out the girl I was friendly with and told her, "You have two choices. You can either leave your job immediately without compensation or any other wages or anything, you leave your job today and go home, or or Martin always, I see to it that he's taken to Dachau concentration camp. So the girl was decent enough to leave her job and go home and saved my life. The funny thing is, by the time this happened, we had more or less decided that it was getting too dangerous to keep up that friendship. And I knew nothing of what had happened until about a year or two later, a year later, when I happened to be on the same train coming home from Munich. She lived in a place halfway between Munich and Landshut. And she was on that train, and I happened to say hello to her. But I walked past, and I sat in another carriage, and she came through to my carriage and then told me that whole story. I said, "What did your father say when you had to, when you came home?" She said, "My father said, did you steal?" I said, "No." I told him why I had to quit my job. And he said, "Well, I'm not telling you off. So I probably have to thank her readiness to sacrifice her job for my life, which I've never forgotten, a girl." In 1935 or 36, of course, the Nazis introduced the so-called Nuremberg Laws, when it became socially impossible for Jewish people to be in any sports club or do socially anything whatsoever. And then I joined the Jewish sports club in Augsburg, the town of Augsburg. And I joined there. We had a Jewish football team, a tennis team, God knows what. And this is where I got to know my wife, because she was a member of that club, because she came from Augsburg. She and her parents lived in Augsburg. So from then on, I traveled more or less every Sunday. We played against other Jewish clubs in Bavaria, in Nuremberg, and so on. So I lived quite a nice social life within within the Jewish population of Bavaria, until the 9th of November 1938.